Hi, I'm Mark Chavez. I'm one of the hosts of Let's Make a comedy docuseries podcast about the creative process. Each season, my co-hosts, Ryan Beal, Maddie Kelly, and I take on an artistic challenge and you follow our journey. In Let's Make a Sci-Fi, we wrote a science fiction TV pilot. In Let's Make a Rom-Com, we wrote a romantic comedy film. And on our latest season, Let's Make a Horror, we produced a horror short film. And when we run into trouble, we interview Hollywood experts. People who have worked on big things like The Blair Witch Project, The Office, Star Wars, Mamma Mia, and more. All three seasons of Let's Make a are available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Q. So you might remember if you listened to the Noah Kahn conversation we had on the podcast not that long ago, I tried to open with a nice breezy question. You know, I think I said I'm going to open with a nice breezy question. And my nice breezy question was, how authentic are you in your day-to-day life? So today, I promise we're going to start with an actual nice, breezy, easy question for you. Ready? How often do you think about the world ending? Okay, I'll try again tomorrow. If you do think about this a lot, I have a show for you. Actually, if you don't ever think about it, I still have a show for you. It's called We're All Gonna Die, Even Jay Baruchel. It follows the Canadian actor, writer, and director Jay Baruchel, who you might know from movies like Blackberry, This Is the End, Knocked Up. He voices the Viking Hiccup in the massively popular How to Train Your Dragon franchise. He got a start in shows like Popular Mechanics for Kids. He went on to star in a show called Undeclared, which is one of Judd Apatow's earliest shows. And in this show, We're All Gonna Die, Jay talks to experts about all the ways we could die. Last season, Jay learned about asteroids and climate change and alien invasions. And now for the second series, who'da thunk it, there are so many more ways to die. Now, before you think this conversation is all about death, it's not. I mean, it's a bit about death, but we also get into the story of Jay's career too, like how the questionable decisions of a TV network tanked the first big TV series he was ever in, and what it's like to make the decision not to be a movie star and come home to Canada. Here's my conversation with Jay Baruchel. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you, man?
Good. You know, it's always nice to see you.
Likewise. I adore chatting with you anytime I get the chance to.
Set the bar low for me, will you? Set the bar low for me. Okay, here's how I want to start this interview. What's the earliest you can remember feeling existential dread?
Oh, yeah. It's like my first memory. I have one of my earliest memories is of this, like, well, two things. It's crazy. No one's ever asked me that question. But two things, two of my earliest memories are like, one is when I was like three and I had a real bad nightmare and my mother, like, it woke me up. It was so bad and it messed me up. And I think I was like, there was like a giant spider monster and I was like driving underneath it and it was trying to eat us or something. And my mother made me draw it and then mail it to grandmother. And that way it wouldn't bother me anymore.
Did it work?
Yeah, like a charm. And we ended up kind of weaving that into the storytelling this season. Because we realized when I told them that, they were like, oh, you've been doing a version of this show since you were a child. The other one is...
Hold on, you've been doing a version of the show since you were a child, writing down and
you know,
the things that you're the most afraid of and giving them to people.
And trying to find a way to...
get them off your mind.
Yeah, okay. or sort them out in some way, you know. And then the other one was like... this was back in an era when my mom still went to church. My mother was Catholic. My father was Jewish. But my mother back then she was so Catholic that she like even baptized me in secret. And it once, like, you know, she made a deal with my father. Like, I wouldn't get baptized. No, I will be a non-denominational child.
Right.
And then mom was bathing me. And she says, like, you know, you don't need a priest. Sometimes in an emergency, a mom can do it.
Really? And, I didn't know. Is that in the catechism?
She claimed it was. So my mother baptized me, but like bought me my children's Bible when I was like two or three, and there's this image in it of the flood, And it's like, there's just like, you know, one little dude on a boat and a bunch of like, you know, everyone else getting drowned, all these animals drowned. And I started bawling my eyes out. And my mother was explaining to me why God did this. And I was like, well, why would that happen? What an awful thing to do. And she still talks about to this day that she regrets buying me that Bible and reading it. She thought she was doing what you're supposed to do as a, yeah, as a mom. And she ended up scaring the hell out of me instead. So this is all to say that I've been scared of this big thing we call the world and existence since I was a child.
Since the very beginning. So was any of this on your mind when you agreed to do the show, when you took on the show in, at first?
I see, it's a hard thing to put my finger on because it's not like that's the only time that I thought about that stuff.
Yeah.
I have been, we moved back to Montreal in 94, the year before the 95 referendum. We were Anglos on the English side of the city. I then went to the States when I was 18 during the George W. Bush, Al Gore election Florida nonsense, and then everything that came after that.
Yeah.
And so this is all to say that like I don't really remember a time where I wasn't kind of worried that the world was going to end in some way, or that's, you know, like I also I just like my tastes and my interests always skewed a bit heavy. I always liked, you know, American Justice with Bill Curtis talking about serial killers, right, and like the Time Life box set of like, you know, the history of the illustrated history of the SS, and like I just love heavy shit.
You love a bit of darkness. You love
For whatever combination of reasons. Probably because my parents, you know, were screaming at each other when I was a child.
You think that might be it?
Well, I mean, it's not a lot of 12-year-old insomniacs, you know?
Right.
And if you were to ask me when I was 12, are you, you know, upset? Are you responding? I'm happy as a pig.
Sure, you wouldn't know any difference.
Reading comics,
but now
movies.
Looking back, maybe with a little bit of couch time under your belt, you start to realize one.
Absolutely. That. And I don't want to diminish it because I don't think it's always good to know why you like a thing. But if I was being uber analytical about it, I'd say, yeah, all of it's a self-defense mechanism. Yeah.
Against?
If I read about heavy, scary that's heavier and scarier than what's happening in front of me, I am less at mercy of the things in front of me.
Yeah, I understand. I listened to this podcast one time with Conan O'Brien, and he said something like, if you're a student of history, you'll be less anxious.
He's right. Yeah. He's absolutely right. Yeah. He and I have talked about that stuff.
Really?
Because we both have the same crippling addiction to the Second World War history. And so we will just email each other the heaviest, nerdiest stuff. And I think that, like, yeah, there's a bunch of different reasons why we find it interesting, but I definitely think that it helps put everything else into perspective in front of you.
The AI episode, which is the first episode of this new season, can you talk a little bit about what you learned about AI?
Yeah, just that it's going to be powerful in a way that we can't quite appreciate until it's too late, I think. And too late, I just mean once we realize, I think, the profundity and the power of this technology and the kind of effects it's going to have on us, it will be too late to undo it.
Right.
And I think it's kind of like nuclear fission or the internet. Like, it's already turned on.
Yeah.
And it's increasing exponentially and evolving really, really quickly. And the number – everyone keeps coming back to this sort of like 4 to 5 years from now. 4 to 5 years from now will be the time that, you know, there is some degree of like what could be called sincere sentience and stuff for us to be concerned about.
We're building these really powerful, intelligent tools, and we could be giving them really powerful weapons for doing so.
But ultimately, it is going to be as good or bad as we are. Like any tech.
Yeah.
You know?
They're only reflections, only tools and reflections of ourselves.
Ultimately, unless they do us all in, yeah.
I have found in the past couple of years meditating on death. I've never talked about this before.
Oh, cool.
Meditating on death, a comforting thing for me. I meditate a lot.
Yeah.
And I did this course one time, and it was like one of the things part of requirements of this course I was doing was you had to do this one meditation about death, and I put it off forever. I don't like it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, but then I eventually did it, and the world felt so much richer to me afterwards.
Sure.
I remember that night I saw Charlotte Day Wilson play a show, and I sat down and I went, I can't believe I'm alive.
It's special.
And I'm alive for this, and I get to experience this. It actually made life feel richer, meditating on death.
Absolutely.
Has any of this done that for you?
Yeah. I the biggest takeaway that, like, as a 90s kid, I am, like, so embarrassed to say what I'm about to say, which is, like, if high school me heard me say this, they'd be like, oh,
you're cool Gen Xer? Is that what you are?
I just was like, I went to fine arts high school in Montreal. I graduated in 99. We were raised to think everything was everything was awful. And if you thought anything was good, you were like, I don't know, right? And so, no, it's made me an optimist. It's made me an optimist. For the first For the first time in my life, I'm optimistic.
How?
So I want to preface it by saying that, like, I am fully aware, and I don't want to step on anybody's strife or difficulties. It's heavy as fuck out there, and it's hard times for a lot of people across the world.
Got it.
But when you zoom out and you go and look at our story as a species and this human saga, we are healthier, living longer, more literate, well, better fed, killing each other less at odds with disease than ever in our history. And it's a piece of shit out there. And it anecdotally is a piece of shit. And it's really ugly. But this is the best it's ever been. And so when I say it's made me an optimist, it's like one of the things I kind of realized in doing the show was there's never been a time in human history where we weren't worried the world was going to end tomorrow. And potentially it's too cute to say that that's a function of us being the only animal that knows we're going to die. I'm worried I'm going to die. When you zoom out and look at billions of us, we're worried the planet's going to die. And we always have been. And we've been convinced we're like, it's coming down the pike many times.
Yeah.
So, but you also don't want to say, so smoke if you got them, it's Miller time, because it isn't. The world is still a piece of shit, and there's work for all of us to be done, and there's a load for each of us to carry. There's a piece for each of us to carry. But by and large, we are doing better.
Yeah.
At the very least, it's about the same. We are better at some stuff, worse at other stuff. Every generation.
I mean, I can see how that'd be comforting. I can see some kind of comfort in that.
You know, it just is like it makes it not novel and not unique, and it makes it something that is like part and parcel with this thing that we call being people.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. You're in the middle of my conversation with the very Canadian actor, Jay Baruchel. His series, We're All Gonna Die, Even Jay Baruchel, just released its second season on Crave. We've been talking about the doom and gloom of existential dread and how the world might end, since that's what the show is about. But at this point in the conversation, I wanted to know more about Jay's story. I'd heard this story about, like, when he was 9 years old, he went up to his mom and sort of presented the idea that he wanted to be a director and not an actor. How do you know that about yourself? What does that conversation look like with your mom? I asked him. Take a listen.
The first time in grade three, Miss Donovan and Father Vernini in Oshawa, Ontario, she had us all like write stories. And it was this like my head exploded because I was like, there's this world and I decide what happens. And I get to create all these characters just like my favorite heroes. And I get to do. And it was just this idea. It was my like I remember the first time that I was like allowed to create and realized I'd always been doing it, playing cops and robbers or whatever in the backyard with my G.I. Joes. But but putting a name on it kind of, you know. And so at like seven, there's video footage of me in our little house around Christmas. My mother said, John, what do you want to do when you grow up? I said, I want to make movies that would – I want to scare Stephen King out of his underwear is what I said when I was seven on camera to my mother. And then at nine, I realized – so at seven, I said, I want to be an author. At nine, I kind of sharpened that, got a bit more precise with it, where I said, I want to write movies and direct movies. At 12 is when, like, my dad got a brochure for this, like, kids acting class in a church basement. And, you know, I always, like, had too much energy and couldn't keep my mouth shut. And, you know, and dad knew I wasn't going to play hockey or do any of the shit he wanted me to do. So this was his means of, like, finding a thing that he thought I could do because every kid needs a thing to do.
Yeah.
And so... But what's funny is like when I started, when I got like an agent at 12 and everything, my mother said to me, she goes, you know, you want to be a director. You want to make movies. I bet you this is probably the best way to learn how. This will be like film school. If you treat it like film school, this will be the best education you could ever get. So even at 12 on set, I was like, I was there as a function of loving movies, not loving acting. And so I have like, so I've been very, I've been spoiled for riches.
What's the difference?
Well, it's like some people are in movies because they love acting, and acting is the thing.
They so, love the process of getting into a character.
And building and all that. Yeah. And some people just like acting because it allows them to be in movies.
Right.
Movies are the thing for me. I don't read books about acting. I don't listen to people talk about acting. I read books about movies and hear people talk about filmmaking all the time. And so, like, I love storytelling. I like building movies.
That's the difference. You love storytelling, not necessarily the craft.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate and grateful for – I'm fortunate for the career I've had. Very grateful because less than 20% of actors can feed themselves from acting, and I've been able to have a career. I've been on set every year since 1995. Wow. So, like, it's – I'm very, very – reverent and grateful, but it was never my raison d'être, mm-hmm. and it was everything I did, and so it's like one of these kind of champagne problems where every kind of bit of success I had as an actor was like lovely and wonderful, and I got to learn more about making movies, but it also kept delaying my thing, which was if you'd asked me at 16 or 17 in high school, what do you want to do? What are you going to do? And what's the next 10 years of your life look like? I was like, well, you know, I was a kid actor in Montreal and I saved some of my money and I'll live off that as long as I can. I was like, I want to go to film school and I wanted to go to film school in Britain. I was like convinced that's where I had to go and that's all my favorite directors were coming from there. So I was like looking at all these film schools in England and I was like telling my folks that like, I just want to write and direct like straight to video horror movies. And if I'll live off the money I made as a kid, mm-hmm. as long as I can, mm-hmm. then I'll find a job at a video store or something to pay the rent. But all I'll do is write scripts in my bedroom. And, you know, and so I was trying to make like, I don't know if you know what the Full Moon Pictures are, the Band Brothers, Albert Band and Charles Band.
Yeah, yeah.
Big inspiration for me. And that's what I was hoping. That's kind of the track that I was on.
What's wrong, Tess?
Bill Honegger's dead.
How did Honegger get it?
He didn't. That's the trouble.
What?
Poor guy just dropped dead.
I was going to go to England, learn my craft, come back to Canada and make a bunch of B-movies.
So how old when Undeclared happens?
18.
Undeclared, for people who don't know, is this show. I and I think I'm allowed to say this now in the CBC, I illegally downloaded it.
Oh, good. Yes, good on you. Yeah, yes.
I got it off like LimeWire.
LimeWire, I think a lot of people did.
Yeah.
It's fine. I bet you on LimeWire the episode order was in the proper sequence because on the box set it is not.
Oh, really?
Yep.
That's not ideal.
No, it isn't.
I remember downloading Undeclared and really enjoying it. For people who don't know, Undeclared was a show you were on where you played. I got it here. A college freshman at the fictional University of Northeastern California. Yeah. You and Seth Rogen in it.
And a bunch of people. Jason Segel.
Pretty good.
Yeah, not bad. Charlie Hunnam. A bunch of big ass writers and directors started on that show too.
Guess what? I did it. I did the deed. Honestly, it was awesome. It sure seemed like it took a long time. I don't know about maybe 2.5 minutes or so. It was wicked.
So how does Undeclared happen?
So I was like playing PlayStation. I think it was PlayStation 1. I think I was like playing like Metal Gear in my sister's bedroom because she had the PlayStation. So I was like playing on her, you know, and the phone rang, home phone, and I answered it. And they said, is Jay there? This is like not something... Not a bunch of adults calling on like the long distance ring from the States, you know, and
in the afternoon.
Yeah. And I said, I'm so and so from Allison Jones Casting, and we're casting a show called The Untitled Judd Apatow Project. We saw you in a movie, we saw you in Almost Famous. We think you'd be right for this show.
I forgot you were in Almost Famous.
I said, would you like to audition for it? And I was like, I sure would. And they called me directly at home, which is just like, I want to tell everybody that's never how it happens. and like, it's not like my. How I got onto Undeclared is just like, it's like something out of a book. And so I put myself on tape and they flew me down for a screen test and I got the gig. Yeah.
And now are you feeling like, okay, I got my shag Full Moon Features. I got my ticket written for me.
No, certainly not. I and that's, I think, what'll like... ingratiated me to as many people as it as I probably as I probably disenfranchised in that era, where I was like the biggest homer. I only wore stuff with like Montreal or the maple leaf on it, the red maple leaf, not the blue one. I want to be very, very specific.
Yeah, I got you.
But I only wore Canada. I talked about Canada with everybody that I possibly could. So I think that like if you grew up in Montreal in a household that voted no in the referendum, you are steeped in a sort of real vital form of patriotism.
Because you had a decision to make.
And it was my, and I'm in front of the voting place at 12 years old with all the other kids from our neighborhood with Canadian flag face paint on us, you know, and so it was how I defined myself. And like patriotism for me was never kind of quaint or goofy in the us and them sort of crucible of Montreal in the 90s. It was very much us. And then I go to the States, you know, where I was just like, I went there proud to be Canadian, and being there made me probably even louder and prouder about it. And it was also, I'm 18, 19 at that era where you start speaking to the world turned up to 11 or 12. You have to figure out your pitch and you have to scream and you probably hit stuff too hard and put too fine a point on stuff.
Yeah.
And I was very much that guy in terms of like Canadian content. But what I'll say is it's like a generation of people in LA that grew up knowing every weird Canadian deep cut because of me. But you know,
they were talking about the Edison twins.
Everything.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah,
so
yeah.
My first time I voted, I was in LA, 18 years old. And I was like, oh shoot, I'm going to be in LA. I'm going to miss my first chance to vote in a federal election in Canada. I've been waiting for this my entire life. So I applied. I voted in absentia. And I remember, so I voted via fax machine at the production office for Undeclared in my first Canadian federal election when I was 18 years old.
That's very cool.
I was psyched about it. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah.
This is weird to say. That show didn't work out.
No, not at all. No, because it didn't have a laugh track on it, which for people now,
is that what it was? Because The Office doesn't have a laugh track.
Nothing does anymore.
Right.
Like, but back then, we were literally, I swear to God, studio and network notes would be, but how will the audience know when to laugh? And we were always like, hopefully because we did something funny.
I can't believe they're showing us American Pie like, for free.
Oh, I know. I mean, college is so awesome. And the movie's rated R. Hey, I hear Tara Reid is single. Think I've got a chance? Not my type.
But in the landscape of, because that's in an era where you're still watching on traditional, you know, cable TV networks. There was a very set specific definition of what a sitcom was.
Yeah.
And ours wasn't that. And so it was just kind of like, you can only name like maybe Dream On and one or two other weird kind of like HBO-ish Sex in the City that. It was allowed to have no laugh tracks, but nothing on a big network, a comedy, could have no laugh track. And we were meant to be on after that 70s show. And so what's so interesting, a lot of kids of that 70s show like loved our show. And Topher Grace got written onto our show as like a guest spot. And then the creator of that 70s show lost his shit about it. And there was this big row between him and Judd Apatow over Topher being in an episode of Undeclared. And then our show got canceled. And here's the real reason it didn't connect. So the lack of laugh track is why the like network didn't get behind it and didn't believe in it.
Yeah.
But the reason why it couldn't build an audience was the network, in their infinite wisdom, had a very kind of facile approach to audience building, which was play all of your episodes with famous guest stars in a row and then people will tune in.
Yeah, there's a Sandler episode. I remember
there's
that.
A Sandler episode. There's Will Ferrell when he's still on SNL. There's Amy Poehler before she's on SNL. There's Ben Stiller. There's like a whole bunch of
and they said just put them all in a row. Put them all.
And we had been building a narrative and the show is kind of serialized. And so you would. But Fox was like, it doesn't matter. If they like it and they see someone famous, they'll stick around. So there would be characters that weren't guest stars that would just come and go. And any sort of like semblance of a narrative that you were
so
continuing.
Interesting.
Yeah, nobody could understand. Everybody thought that they had missed it. Every audience member felt like they had missed an episode.
Part one of my conversation with the actor Jay Baruchel. He's the host, director, and executive producer of the series We're All Gonna Die, Even Jay Baruchel. Season two is out now. Coming up on the show, you're going to hear more of our conversation, including we talk about this story I had heard about him that he had sort of rejected Hollywood. He had said no to the hamster wheel of Hollywood and moved back to Canada. That's a great story for someone like me, but like, what's the reality of it? What's the truth? It's after this on Q.
One of the best shows of the year, according to Apple, Amazon, and Time, is back for another round. This season, we're diving deep into some of McCartney's most beloved songs. Yesterday, Band on the Run, Hey Jude. And McCartney's favorite song in his entire catalogue. Here, there, and everywhere. Listen to Season 2 of McCartney, A Life in Lyrics, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. You're in the middle of my conversation with the Canadian, very Canadian, actor Jay Baruchel. We've been talking about season two of his docuseries, We're All Gonna Die, Even Jay Baruchel, which is about the myriad ways we could all meet our collective demise. Uplifting stuff. We talked a bit about why his first big series, Undeclared, made by the great Judd Apatow, why that didn't work. He kind of spilled the tea about exactly what happened on the inner machinations of that show and the network and why it didn't work out. But in this next half, one of the things I'm interested on the show is sort of like trying to figure out the stories you hear about somebody in the media and trying to figure out what the truth of it is. The story about Jay that I had heard was he had moved to L.A. All of a sudden, he's in big movies like Knocked Up and Tropic Thunder and She's Out of My League. And then something happens where he looks at Hollywood. In my mind, he gets on like the top of the Hollywood sign, looks at the entire city and goes like, no. And then he goes home to Canada. So I asked him about it. Here's how he describes in his own words what was going on at that time in his life.
Two things in me were in direct conflict, and one won out over the other. And the two things that were in direct conflict was like, so I was like a angry young man full of piss and vinegar and small man syndrome, and I inherited my father's sense of competitiveness, and, you know, I made every audition I went to a softball game or whatever. I had to beat somebody. I had to win. I was, you know, and so I treated it like, so the competition, the competitive part of me, crossed with the fact that there's a lot of people that were like in movies that I thought couldn't act their way out of a paper bag, yeah. And I would act circles around them.
Yeah.
So those two things conspired to like tell me that I should maybe go for the brass ring.
You're thinking, hey, I'm as good as any of these people.
And because it was there for me, man. Like, I kept getting gigs.
Yeah.
I never didn't get a gig. I would go down for pilot season, which if you don't know what pilot season is, they cast all the pilots that are like the first episode of a show that might not go, right? But they cast all those pilots and they shoot them all in the beginning of the year. And then hopefully one of them turns into a TV show that comes out in the fall. So you would just go as an actor down there for 2 months and spend thousands of dollars on accommodations and all this. And just hustle, hit the pavement, trying to get to auditions. And I always got stuff. And so I kept getting booking stuff. So I was like, you know what? I'm better than that dude. And mm-hmm. I'm and it's here for me. I want this. I'm going to go for it. And I thought, and because it's also like, I'll be honest, like poor kid, where like it took me up until like literally just a few years ago that I didn't still take pop cans home from the cooler on set just because like,
yeah,
I
can't get that stuff out.
I never had any. Yeah. Money as a kid, and so I would like I felt it behooved me to take everything, and so the poor kid, competitive and chip on my shoulder, I went for the brass ring. And there was this year where I did like I had 5 features come out in a calendar year.
What, do you remember what they were?
Trotsky, She's Out of My League, How to Train Your Dragon.
Kids, what are you doing? We need her to like us. And now the spinning. Thank you for nothing, you useless reptile.
Probably Sorcerer's Apprentice, and maybe Tropic Thunder 2.
Now, whichever format porno backs is usually the one that becomes the most successful. But, you know, Sony, every PlayStation 3 has a Blu-ray.
You talking to me this whole time?
I was talking to whoever was listening.
Christ, man.
And then I remember the moment. So this is the moment.
This is why, and
this is who won out. So the little piss and vinegar cocksure kid got summarily dismissed by the real me, which is I don't like doing things, most things. So
you don't strike me as a like.
Well, what I mean is my managers called me and were like, okay, so press tour, first she's out of my league. You're going to go here, and then you go to Phoenix, and then you go to Philadelphia, and then you're going to go to this, and then you're going to go there, and then you'll have a month off, and then you go into the press tour for this, that, and the other one, and then you're going to go to this one, and then this. And so I had this year of promoting the movies ahead of me, and I remember standing in my bedroom in Montreal, had this moment where I felt like I was on a roller coaster as it was getting to its, like, you know, slowly clicking as up to the top before it dips down. And I fucking hate roller coasters. And I was like, nobody told you to do this. Like, nobody put a gun to your head and said, you got to try to be a movie star. You put yourself in this situation.
Yeah. You put yourself in the roller coaster.
And so all of this stuff is your fault. And so everything. And so I got a taste of it. I had publicists, I had stylists, I had people dressing me. I was doing all the, not for me. And I realized that, like, I am, so whatever I've been since then is kind of much closer to my comfort zone.
Do you have to tell someone in America, no, I'm good, I'm out of here?
Yeah, but they were used to it. Because, like, I go back to what I said before about being, like, this, like, an annoying, insufferable kid when I was 18, where, like, I'd be repped at CAA, which is a pretty big talent agency. Yeah. And once a year, they would sit me down for a talking to. And once a year, they'd be like, Jay, we can't represent you if you live in Canada. And I'd say, okay, guys, it's been a slice. Thank you so much for your time.
That's a powerful thing to be able to do, by the way.
And I kept fucking booking things.
Yeah.
You still want that 10%, I bet.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, right.
And so I just, like, not that anybody can. I don't want to say this is because there's not a lesson to be learned. Just do what you got to do. I'm just saying for me, I didn't want to do it the other way. They told me, you know, you got to stick down here for years. And once you get to a level, you can live wherever you want to live. And I remember talking about one actor in particular when I sat that year where I was like saying to my people, I want to go for it. I'm having a bite with my agent. And I mentioned one actor in particular who's famous. I said, like, if I don't get hired, that's fine. That's on me. But give me the same scripts. And you put me next to him, I promise you, I beat him every day of the week. And he goes, I agree. But you know about the difference is he plays the game.
He goes to stuff.
He plays the game. He goes to the right parties. He's at every event. He never misses a thing. I can't get you to come see me. And so I always, like, willed my own personal preferences on top of everything else.
For better or for worse is interesting because there's one thing you learn from, not to be cheesy and tie back to the show, but back to, like, meditating on death, there is no for better or for worse.
Correct.
And I am resistant to the narrative that was crazy.
Thank you. So am I. I've had an awesome life.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing.
I just think it's weird that I think it's weird that on the way in here, I read so many articles about it. They were like, if you don't mind me saying so, like, what the hell? Like, he had it all. He's in, you know? And then, like, I've heard, every now and then someone tells me, like, oh, Jay's out and he's out in the East. I don't want to say where you live. Yeah. Jay's out in the East End of Toronto. Mm. He's doing a big multi-million dollar movie, How to Train Your Dragon stuff,
yes.
You know? And
yes.
He seems very happy. And I'm like, I don't know. That seems to be actually kind of all right.
Thank you. I just, like, I'm very content.
Yeah.
Like, I built and live in the life that I want. And I think that, like, if you don't see me in shit, because I don't want to be in shit, mm-hmm. I'm more famous than I'm comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you who was, like, a big inspiration for me was Mike Smith, who plays Bubbles on the Trailer Park Boys. All of them, the three of them, all bought houses in Dartmouth,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and the world comes to Dartmouth, mm-hmm. And the world brings them to them, but they still live their LA rock star life in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, and They have nice houses and nice cars, and they live the life that they want to live at home. Like, I was like, that's exactly what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, because what are you going to do? Get a palace in West Hollywood with pillars? And, you know?
I don't want to live. I want to live in Canada, as crazy as that sounds.
The Blackberry movie that you're in, we had Matt Johnson in for it, and we had Glenn Howard in for it too.
Very smart, kind men.
This is not to overstate it, but the Blackberry movie doing as well as it did and getting as much attention as it did in terms of being a Canadian film that's not getting called a Canadian film all the time. Yeah. Everything you just told me about your whole Hollywood experience, it got to be gratifying to watch that film do as well as it's doing.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
That's like on a spiritual level.
Completely. Completely. And it's like – and I don't want to ruin it by like – getting a kick out of being proved right about something. Because I think it's just like, I want to make good shit. And I would have every year my agents in the States tell me, like, if it was up to you, all you would do would be like these independent movies in Canada. And I was like, yeah, God forbid. You know? And, but like, I'm super proud of being part of adding to the English Canadian kind of cultural tapestry, the Goon Flicks and Blackberry. And, you know, these are things that, and Trotsky and Good Neighbors, and these are things that mean things to people. And I'm really proud of getting to leave them behind. And yes, absolutely. When a movie like Blackberry that is like a small Canadian movie that, you know, I won't say they were talking me out of doing, but it was like, because it was potentially in conflict with a big American thing, and it was always like, why would you choose this thing? Well, it's nice when a year later, after an ovation at Berlin, when we come down to LA to show it, and every agent that told me, you know, I should have done the other thing, is like, this is incredible. You guys are amazing. How'd you guys do this? What's the budget of this? Holy shit. Just like, you know, and that's what happened on Goon, too. And it's just like people down there have to be reminded that we're more than just a service industry. Like, we're not just the place you come to make the flash.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we're not just the tax break.
No, man. That we have stuff to say and that we'll figure out a way to do it that, you know, in a more real, dirty way that is going to, like, change the landscape for the next decade.
It's really, really exciting. Hey, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Joyful as always. My conversation with Jay Baruchel, the host, director, and executive producer of We're All Gonna Die, Even Jay Baruchel, Season 2, is out now on Crave. The other conversation we have up today is with Love a Story Like This. Love a Story Like This. Check this out. Alexandre Hamel, competitive figure skater. You know, he would skate and people would hold up the white signs with numbers between 1 and 10 on them. He says that's not an art form. He quits and starts like the Fugazi of figure skating, the Minor Threat of figure skating, the, in some ways, Cirque du Soleil of figure skating. And he's here for a very direct conversation about why we need to be thinking about figure skating as an art. Okay, go check that out. We'll see you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.